Ezekiel 3 and verse 14. Ezekiel, as we will discover as we come to look at it in more detail, but Ezekiel at this point is being called by God. And he is, at this point, being moved and carried about by the Spirit of God, in some sense. But Ezekiel 3, verse 14 then says, "So the Spirit lifted me up and took me away, and I went in bitterness, in the heat of my spirit, but the hand of the Lord was strong upon me." There was a plan in Ezekiel's life. Ezekiel, at the age of 25, which was the age when he was carried into Babylon, knew the plan for his life. He was a priest, or at any rate was certainly going to be a priest, if not already. It was his calling and destiny. He was born in a priestly line, the son of a priest. His was a privileged role among a privileged people. He was to serve Israel, the nation that God had chosen, in the temple in Jerusalem, the one place in all the world that God had made to be his dwelling place, and which by ancient covenant would forever remain. This was the plan for Ezekiel's life. And like most of us, when there was a challenge to the plan for his life, he didn't much like the idea of changing it. And I would suggest that as we read the opening chapters of Ezekiel, and perhaps read between the lines slightly, this is largely what is going on in those opening chapters. The chapters are about the commissioning, if you like, of Ezekiel, the calling of Ezekiel to be a prophet of the Lord. And as we read them, I think we could say the overall tone suggests a certain reluctance on the prophet's part, but it's highlighted particularly in verse 14, our text, and we'll look a bit more detail in a moment. But it's that phrase there, "I went in bitterness in the heat of my spirit," but we'll look at that in a moment. And this brings us to our first point this evening, and that is the juxtaposition between Ezekiel's plan and God's plan. You know, it's fascinating to read these opening few chapters of Ezekiel. We don't find there one who, in response to the Lord's question, "Whom shall I send?" like Isaiah says, "Here I am, send me." No, rather here we have one to whom the Lord has to say in Ezekiel 2 verse 8, "Be not thou rebellious like that rebellious house. Open thy mouth and eat that I give thee." Or one who, even after he has eaten what seemed to him lamentations, mourning and woe in verse 10 of chapter 2, and finds that it is in fact sweet in Ezekiel 3 verse 3, still only goes where God wishes him to go because the hand of the Lord is strong upon him, as in our text. And even as the Lord transports him in that verse, "The Spirit lifted me up and took me away," he goes in bitterness and in the heat of his spirit. Now let's not beat about the bush here. Ezekiel is not happy with what's going on. The word translated as bitterness could conceivably be to do with the fact with what he's just read about in this scroll that he had there. Lamentations, mourning and woe. Perhaps he's going in bitterness of spirit and sorrow. But the next phrase, "in the heat of his spirit," doesn't leave us with any ambiguity. It's a word which unequivocally denotes anger. And it's a word which, as we go on, or if we were to go on in Ezekiel, we would find is regularly used to denote God's anger and fury. an example being one of many. I think there's something like 31 or so uses of the word in Ezekiel. But just as an example of one, Ezekiel 5:15. So it shall be a reproach and a taunt, an instruction and an astonishment unto the nations that are round about thee, when I shall execute judgments in thee, in anger and in fury and furious rebukes. And it's that word fury there, which is the same word which Ezekiel uses of himself in that verse 14. And you know, the longer, and I know that I'm still quite young, but the more I go on as a Christian, the more I come to see how hard this matter can be for us. We all make plans. We can't help it. And to a certain extent, it's sensible. We need to plan for the future. Wisdom demands that we should plan for the future. It's arguable that many of the problems we face as an economy and as a nation, certainly if we think about it materially, are to do with people not planning for the future. But what do we do when our plans are turned on their heads? Well, I would suggest that our natural response is like Ezekiel's. We don't want it. We fight against it. And that is what happened with Ezekiel. And we'll just have a look for a moment at how that happened with Ezekiel. God demolishing Ezekiel's plans for the future. Well, first of all, and primarily, in fact, really, Ezekiel's plans were demolished in the Babylonian exile. At 25 years old, in the river 597 BC, Ezekiel, along with Jehoiakim and others, was taken in captivity to Babylon. Just in case you're wondering where I've got that 25 from, if you turn to Ezekiel 1, verse 1, you'll notice that it says at the beginning of that, "Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month." And there's quite a bit of debate in commentaries and so on of what that is talking about. The natural reading, perhaps, as if you took it as it is generally, things are generally dated in the book, would be to take it as the 30th year from the captivity. But of course, that doesn't make any sense. And in fact, later on, we are told that it was in verse 2, in the fifth day of the month, which was the fifth year of the King Jehoiakim's captivity. And I think that the most sensible position is that that 30th year is talking about, in fact, Ezekiel's own age at that point. And I think that's a bit of a clue that this was quite important for him from a personal point of view. So Ezekiel, but 5 years before that, Ezekiel had been taken captive. And so that's where we get the age 25 from. So he was taken in captivity at the age of 25 years old, either already a priest, perhaps recently ordained as one, or soon to be one. It says there, Ezekiel, in verse 3, Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi. But in the Hebrew, it's slightly ambiguous as to whether it's Ezekiel's already a priest or whether he's something which is going to come later. But he's either just become a priest, because 25 would have been quite young, or he's going to be one shortly. But that is taken away from him. He's taken to captivity in Babylon, to a location, Tel Abib, thought to be in modern-day Iraq, and by one of the canals used to transport water from probably from one of the major rivers, either the Tigris or the Euphrates. And we must recognise, I think, the importance in this, not only in shattering Ezekiel's plans for his own life, but also his idea of God's plan for his people. Now, the rest of the book of Ezekiel will go on to show that the people of the time, and probably this included Ezekiel, at this point anyway, were united in their belief that God would never desert Jerusalem. to such an extent that even after the first captivity, the people maintained their belief that the captivity would be over very shortly, very soon, and certainly Jerusalem would never fall. Now, the former idea, the idea that the captivity would be over very soon and very quickly, is seen quite clearly and spelt out for us in the letter which Jeremiah wrote probably around this time to the captives. And we read it in Jeremiah 29. It's a letter that Jeremiah is writing to the captives who have been taken away by Nebuchadnezzar. What he says, Jeremiah 29 verse 8, "For thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, let not your prophets and your diviners that be in the midst of you deceive you, neither hearken to your dreams which ye cause to be prophesied. For they prophesy falsely unto you in my name. I have not sent them, saith the Lord. For thus saith the Lord," verse 10, "that after 70 years be accomplished at Babylon, I will visit you and perform my good word towards you," and so on. And these, this of course is apparently, it seems, going against an idea current at the time that there was going to be a quick delivery. But Jeremiah writes and says, no, there's none of that. It's going to be 70 years before you will be delivered. And we see Ezekiel railing against similar prophets in his own book, Ezekiel 13, verse 10. Even because they have seduced my people, he's talking about false prophets here, saying, peace, and there was no peace, and build up a wall, and lo, others daubed it with untempered mortar. Covering up the cracks, the idea is there, daubing over the wall. There were those who were forecasting a speedy recovery for the people at the time. And Jeremiah addresses this in his book. And the other example, the idea that Jerusalem would never fall, is seen repeatedly in the book of Ezekiel itself, primarily. And we see that as an example in Ezekiel 11 and verse 3. He's speaking about people. In fact, in Ezekiel 11, Ezekiel has been transported to Jerusalem itself by the Spirit. And he sees people he recognises, and what they're saying is, "It is not year, it is not near. Let us build houses. This city is the cauldron, and we be the flesh." Now, in case we misunderstand what he's saying there, he's not saying we're being judged, we're kind of being heated up in a pot, ready to be boiled. What they're saying is that they are the important thing in God's city, the meat, the important part of the meal. That's made clear in verse 11, when the Lord responds and said, "This city shall not be your cauldron, neither shall ye be the flesh in the midst thereof, but I will judge you in the border of Israel." So the people had this idea that Jerusalem is saved, God will never leave it. The Lord will keep his covenant with Israel. And of course, just as one last example, so we've got this clear in our minds, Ezekiel 12:22, a proverb which was going around at the time. "Son of man, what is that proverb that ye have in the land of Israel? The days are prolonged and every vision faileth." The judgment that people are talking about will never come. So therefore, in this culture in which Ezekiel found himself, with this idea of God's preservation of Jerusalem, the importance of Jerusalem to God, Even the captives will soon return, but Jerusalem will never ever fall. That's the general culture, remember. Ezekiel, of course, was taken captive slightly before some of those explicit things might have been said. But imagine then the shock for Ezekiel, who's, as far as we know, is at the time a part of this culture and quite happy with it. Imagine the shock for Ezekiel to hear the words in Ezekiel 2, verses 3 to 4. "And he said unto me, Son of man, I send thee to the children of Israel, to a rebellious nation that hath rebelled against me. They and their fathers have transgressed against me, even unto this day. For they are impudent children, and stiff-hearted. Oh, imagine his shock as he reads the words of lamentations and mourning and woe in Ezekiel 2 verse 10, in the book, the scroll which is given to him. This wasn't how it was supposed to work, thinks Ezekiel and those at his time. Everyone knew that God loved Israel. And was Ezekiel, the son of a priest, one of the ruling class in Judah, to be sent with this message? A message that would certainly bring him hardship and hatred? Well, Ezekiel, as may be expected perhaps, humanly speaking, did resist, as is made plain in our text. And then, as that follows on, is Job-like sitting for 7 days in astonishment in verse 15. Then I came to them of the captivity at Tel Abib that dwelt by the river Kibar, and I sat where they sat, and remained there astonished among them 7 days. Ezekiel is blown away by the message which he receives. It challenges and pulls the rug out of every conception he has about God. Every idea he has about his own calling, every idea he has about the calling of the nation of Israel, is demolished by the message which he has. If you think about it, the people have been taken in captivity, and that's a massive challenge, but they've begun to build things up, as we always do. Little supports to their previous way of thinking, like, oh well, Jerusalem will never fall, that's the important thing, or, well, there's going to be a speedy recovery, it's just a temporary thing, but the Lord comes to him with this message of what he really thinks of Israel. They're impudent children, stiff-hearted. Imagine Ezekiel's astonishment. It's not surprising he sat there for 7 days, speechless. But having seen Ezekiel's difficulty with the message, we might wonder, well, how was he ever brought round? How was he convinced? As he clearly was, because the commissioning of Ezekiel only lasts up to the end of... it's even before that, actually. Well, no, at least it lasts up to the end of chapter 3. So we've got another 45 chapters of Ezekiel delivering the message of God. So how is Ezekiel convinced? How has this all changed around from his being taken in anger at what God is asking him to do? Well, we've seen the difficulties for Ezekiel, and perhaps we can associate ourselves with them. And perhaps there may be a couple of ways that we can apply his position to us before we move on to the remedy, perhaps, the thing which finally convinced Ezekiel. First of all, we may find it difficult, like Ezekiel, to live in the times in which God has called us to live. And secondly, we may find it difficult to live in the situation which God has called us to live. First of all, the times, the period in history to which God has called us. I think I've quoted from this before, but I think it sums up something. In Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, Frodo makes a statement to the effect that he wishes he had not lived to see such days as those in which he lived. And Gandalf's reply is that all who live in such times think the same thing, but that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us. You know, we may read books about revival. We may read of the Reformation, of the Apostles. We may desire to sit with Mary at the Master's feet. And we may fear as we look out on the world about us. Where is everything going? What am I to do in it? This isn't how I thought God's plan was supposed to work. And we see it increasingly, I think, in our day. And I must confess, I do sometimes fear, well, often fear, more than sometimes, where things are going. We see the growth in wickedness and the combined growth in technology and power and the ability for the government to monitor our every communication and almost our every thought. And we wonder how we will live as Christians how we will share the gospel. And we wish, perhaps, that we had not lived to see such times as these. Or in our personal lives, perhaps there was something that you had planned, something important that's fallen through. Perhaps you look at your life now and you think of the way you envisaged it 5 years ago, or maybe even more recently than that, and it's fallen apart. I don't know the details. Maybe hardly anyone does, if anyone at all does. May be different for each of us, but how do we cope? Where do we go? Maybe like Ezekiel, we've had the rug pulled out from under our feet. Maybe we thought that at this point in our lives we'd be in a different place than we are. And maybe we're struggling. But even though it is difficult, and this is where we will come on, really, to look at Ezekiel's solution to it. Even though it is difficult, there is nonetheless a clear calling for us to live the life which God has called us. To come to terms with, if you like, the will of God. Ezekiel must eat the scroll, even though it contains words of lamentation and mourning and woe. He cannot pass it by. Before we go on, there's a very important thing to say here. That when we talk about accepting the will of God, living the life which God has called us, coming to terms with God's will for us, God's purposes for us, I'm not suggesting that we need to run around doing cartwheels about it or something silly like that. We need to be jumping around with joy. You know, later on in the book, Ezekiel is called to sacrifice the dearest earthly thing to him, the desire of his eyes. Ezekiel 24, verse 16. Son of man, behold, I take away from thee the desire of thine eyes with a stroke. Yet neither shalt thou mourn nor weep, neither shalt thy tears run down. He's talking about Ezekiel's wife. And when Ezekiel went out the following morning, as he was commanded, and he didn't show mourning, verse 18, so I spake unto the people in the morning, and at even my wife died, and I did in the morning as I was commanded. Do you suppose that he felt good about it inside? Of course not. And the Lord didn't expect him to. The focus, rather, in Ezekiel's prophecy there is on the external signs of mourning, which Ezekiel is to keep under control. And don't run away with the idea that I'm suggesting, or the Bible is saying, that being willing to follow God's plan rather than our own means we should always feel ecstatic about it. Sometimes it will be hard. And it may involve grief. Go to Gethsemane if you have any doubts about that. Luke 22, verses 42 and 44. The words of the Lord Jesus. Father, if thou be willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. And then verse 44. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was, as it were, great drops of blood falling to the ground. Don't jump to the idea that we're talking about some sort of silly joy in adversity. No. But nonetheless, Ezekiel must, and we must, come to terms, in some sense, come in faith to submit to God's plan over our own. And this is what we see Ezekiel learning in these opening chapters. And the fundamentally key thing to Ezekiel learning that lesson, I would say, is that vision which he has in chapter 1. It's clear that this is foundational to what follows. and Ezekiel's final coming to terms with what God has planned for him. We don't have time to go into this glorious vision in detail, but let us look briefly at the point of it. Well, in it, Ezekiel sees God. And I would suggest that that has to be the starting point for any coming to terms with God's will. A vision of the Almighty. How was Abraham able to sacrifice Isaac? Or be willing to do so? Because he knew God. Because he knew him not to be cruel, not to be evil, but rather to be kind and good. And how will Ezekiel be able to do what God asks of him? By seeing what God is like. By understanding who God is. We see in Ezekiel's vision the Lord God enthroned on a chariot, attended by his cherubim. Ezekiel 1, verses 4 and 5. And I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud and a fire enfolding itself, and a brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof as the colour of amber out of the midst of fire. And also out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. And then verse 15, now, as I beheld the living creatures, behold, one wheel upon the earth by the living creatures with his four faces. The appearance of the wheels and their works was like the colour, was like unto the colour of beryl. And they four had one likeness, and their appearance and their work was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel. And then verse 22, and the likeness of the firmament was upon the heads of the living creatures. And the likeness of the firmament upon the heads of the living creature was as the colour of the terrible crystals stretched forth over their heads above. And then finally, verse 26. And above the firmament that was over their heads was the likeness of a throne. And as the appearance of sapphire stone, and upon the likeness of the throne was the likeness as the appearance of a man above upon it. We have an image of the Lord enthroned above all creation, attended by his cherubim. And while perhaps at one level it symbolises something about the power of God, the power of his chariot as he's there with these cherubim underneath it with their several faces, as we see in verse 6, and every one had four faces, and every one had four wings. And then verse 10, the likeness of their faces, they four had the face of a man, and the face of a lion on the right side, and they four had the face of an ox on the left side, and they four also had the face of an eagle. And there is something here about the awfulness of God's power. Those images meant something to the people of the time, to the Israelites, particularly those in Babylon. And we have the majesty of the eagle and the lion, the working and the power of the ox, and man, the Lord of creation. And it symbolises God's power over them. God's power over all of creation, summed up in those four animals. His chariot is mobile. It's able to go up and down, verse 19. And when the living creatures went, the wheels went by them. And when the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. And the wheels have wheels within wheels, meaning they can go swiftly in all directions. We read that in verse 16. But most importantly for Ezekiel, in this context and time, as I say, there's an awful lot in chapter 1, but we don't have time to go through it all now. But I want to just focus on the most striking thing for Ezekiel. The most striking thing for Ezekiel is that this is in Tel Aviv. Ezekiel, the man steeped in the idea that God has chosen Jerusalem for his dwelling place. And we can think of him perhaps wondering what the point of his life is, as he's there in exile. He's supposed to be a priest. But God isn't here. God's in Jerusalem. But what Ezekiel sees here is the Lord's train freshly come from the temple. And that's an important point. I don't think Ezekiel realizes this right at the beginning. He realizes it in Ezekiel chapter 10 when he's been transported in vision to Jerusalem. And he sees the same chariot coming out of the temple. He sees that in chapter 10. And then he realizes what it was that he'd seen by the river Kibar. Ezekiel 10:19, "And the cherubim lifted up their wings and mounted up from the earth in my sight. When they went out, the wheels also were beside them, and everyone stood at the door of the east gate of the Lord's house, and the glory of the Lord of Israel was over them above. This is the living creature that I saw under the God of Israel by the river Kibar, and I knew that they were cherubims." He realizes there what he's seen in chapter 1. And what he sees in chapter 1 is God in his temple, but not in his temple. What he had learned as a priest was where God dwelt, was in that most holy place. The idea they had of God was of the throne of God in the temple, amidst the cherubim, above the cherubim there, as he sees them indeed here. We know that's how they thought of him, because that's how it's described. We sang it actually in that psalm. But if we look at the words of Hezekiah, we'll see it again there. 2 Kings 19, verse 15. These are the words of Hezekiah. And Hezekiah says, "O Lord God of Israel, which dwellest between the cherubims." And this is the idea they have of God. And this is what he sees here. God amidst the cherubims, but not in the temple. Not limited to Jerusalem. Not limited to the temple. Not even limited to Israel. And it shows him that there is no difference to God whether Ezekiel is in Jerusalem or in Babylon. The sovereign power which is seen and symbolized in the temple could be with him wherever he was. He didn't have to be in Jerusalem. And any ideas which he had, as were common among the nations at the time, that somehow God was the king in Israel, but maybe not in other places. And there's certainly indications that some people in Israel were influenced by such ideas, were blown away by what Ezekiel sees here. And for Hezekiah, it would have turned his world upside down, challenging the notions which have been ingrained within him and which he repeatedly goes on to challenge throughout the book of Ezekiel. His ideas of what the temple is, his ideas of the importance of Jerusalem, his ideas of the importance of Israel. They're ripped up as he sees this vision, and he realizes that God is truly over all. That God is not just the God of Jerusalem. That he can be a servant of God in Babylon as well as in Jerusalem. And brethren, we can be very easily, very like Ezekiel no doubt was. We can have our own idea, which may be based on perhaps the best way we've been brought up to think, and the best way that we've always thought. We can have our own idea of what would be best. Our own idea of what we should be doing and where we should be. What period would have been the best to live in. But I would suggest that no matter how much we may long for something different, if we truly see the message of Ezekiel here, we may find that God is just as powerfully in our own lives and times as he was in the lives of others, and as he was at other times in history and at other places in the world today. And that he can be so in just as glorious and wonderful a way as that idea, perhaps idealized, we have in our minds of other times and other situations. You know, there's a great irony in Ezekiel. Here are all those people in Jerusalem. We read about them in chapter 10. And they still imagine that they're God's chosen people, they're God's chosen ones, and that being in God's chosen city will save them. They're the meat in God's cauldron, the precious ones. But actually, as Ezekiel discovers in chapter 10, what's happening to the train of God's glory? It's coming out of the temple and it's going to Ezekiel. It's visiting those who are supposedly forsaken and leaving those who are supposedly the ones who are the precious ones of God. Ezekiel, and there's no doubt about this, had longed to return to Jerusalem. He thought that was the best place for him. But Ezekiel 10 makes clear, and Ezekiel 1 makes clear, that in fact, God was visiting the exiles. He was better where he was. And that's a serious lesson and challenge for us. We must not spend our time wishing that things were different. Rather, we must realise that as we follow God, God is where we are. No matter how hard the circumstances, God is still gloriously and wonderfully present in the situations to which he has called us to live, and in the times of history to which he has called us. And maybe that's what Ezekiel realized in those 7 days when he sat there in silence, stunned, as his previous worldview was gradually demolished and a new one put in its place. That what seemed to him to be lamentations and mournings and woe could in fact, as he found when he ate the scroll in Ezekiel 3 verse 3, be as honey for sweetness. And I would suggest that if we want to reconsider things, that silence might be a good idea. I know I've said this before when I spoke about Job. But sometimes the ideas we have for our lives might take a bit of time for us to demolish. And we need to be willing to demolish them. It can be tough. It can be difficult. We may have our own cherished idea of what would be best for us. Some hope we have. Some desire. Some cherished idea of what would be best for the country. And within a certain context, of course, there's nothing wrong with that. The psalm we sang earlier is all about, Lord, return to us, visit your vine. It's the people in exile actually saying that. Psalm 80. It's an exilic psalm. But nonetheless, we must demolish the ideas we have, those things which we seek to keep hold of, which we won't let go, which we fight tooth and nail against demolishing. And it can be difficult. And that brings us on, finally, to the role of God himself in all this. God's grace. It may be difficult giving up on that cherished idea. But in Ezekiel, we have the evidence that it can be done by the grace of God. We spoke earlier about Ezekiel 24, verses 15 to 18. And the awful thing to which Ezekiel is there called. Let's just read it. Ezekiel 24, verse 15. And the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, behold, I take away from thee the desire of thine eyes with a stroke. Yet neither shalt thou mourn nor weep, neither shall thy tears run down, Forbear to cry, make no mourning for the dead, bind the tire of thine head upon thee, and put on thy shoes upon thy feet, and cover not thy lips, and eat not the bread of men. So I spake unto the people in the morning, and at the even my wife died. And I did in the morning as I was commanded. Here is the ultimate test for Ezekiel. But see the contrast in him. From the man who was fighting against God in chapter 3, to the man who, even at this awful point in his own personal life, did as he was commanded. That's not to say it was easy again. It's not to suggest he went out in the morning with hardly a care in the world. No. They're not suggesting such crass silliness. But he didn't fight against it as he fought against it in Ezekiel 3:14. And it didn't take him 7 days this time. Somewhere and somehow, by the power of God's Spirit, he had learned to be willing to go where God said. And to be willing to live the life which God had called him to live. And I think we should take that as an encouragement. Had we read chapter 4 without chapter 3 verse 14, we may have imagined that Ezekiel was some sort of super saint. Or else perhaps we may have thought that he had some sort of emotional problem. But no. This was a man who knew what it was to be angry at being told what to do by God. But God had so worked in his life that he was able to even make that ultimate sacrifice in faith to God who is good. It was easy to sing hymns like "Take My Life and Let It Be Consecrated, Lord, to Thee." But can we live it? Can we mean it? It's an awful thing to sing hymns like that crassly without really thinking about them. What we're inviting God to do. But Ezekiel shows us that in fact we can. If we will allow ourselves to be challenged by God out of our own ideas, our own precious thoughts, the things which we keep to ourselves, and that we won't allow anybody to challenge us about, that we can follow God. And perhaps as we close, we could perhaps begin to try and reconsider and challenge and change our ways of thinking. And it is hard, because we're always building up things for the future. We do it in all kinds of things, as I say. Cherished hopes, perhaps even some offence somebody's given us, real or imagined, and we're refusing to let it go. And no matter what anybody explains to us, we want to be angry. But look to Ezekiel. See what was worked in his life. It wasn't what Ezekiel wanted, but what was good. And imagine if Ezekiel had still been fighting against God and he had refused to do what God said. We wouldn't have the book of Ezekiel. And the marvellous passages of hope in the later chapters. Ezekiel may have thought, you see, that he had all the bad things to say. But actually, as you go on in the book of Ezekiel, they become gloriously hopeful and wonderful. But in conclusion, we must look supremely in these things to Calvary and see there that what God plans, though it may seem dark, though they may seem unbearable at the time, no matter how dark they seem, are yet the precursor to a more glorious dawn. At Calvary, what must people have thought? The disciples, crushed, all their hopes gone. But 3 days later, the raising from the tomb, and then Pentecost. But also when we see Jesus, we see the second person of the Holy Trinity, the Son of God. And we know there, and this is where it really comes down to, I think. We said before that the beginning has to be some sort of vision of God. And I don't mean that in any sort of, in a sense mystical, I suppose, but I don't mean it in some sort of strange sense. But we must have some knowledge of God, see some, think of what he is and what he is like. And Ezekiel, in his vision, he sees so many things that show him the holiness, the righteousness of God. If we'd had time to look into the whole chapter, we could have brought some of those things out, perhaps. But when we see the Lord Jesus on Calvary, what do we see? We see the Son of God, the second person of the Trinity, dying for us. And we see there the love of God. And what I would say to you is, when we find it hard, and there's no, I don't want anybody there thinking to themselves, well, Ben doesn't really, it's very easy for him to sit here and talk about these things, but he doesn't know what I'm suffering. Well, that, to a certain extent, that's true. But what I would say to you is, look to God. And when you look at Calvary, you see the love of God, the love of the Lord Jesus. You see other things as well, but we see that supremely. And that one who bore Calvary for you, do you really think that you can't trust him in your own life? Do you really think that with those things that you're finding it so hard to accept, like Ezekiel having to accept his wife dying and not mourn about it? Do you really think that he doesn't care? The one who went to Calvary for you, do you really think you can't trust him? We mentioned earlier in passing Genesis 22 and Ezekiel there. Not Ezekiel, sorry, Abraham there. And he's willing to kill his son Isaac. And why is he willing to kill Isaac? Because he knows God. He knows he isn't evil. But some people today, they call themselves anti-theists. And that's one of the chapters they quote actually, Genesis 22. What kind of God, they say, would command child sacrifice? We shouldn't serve God like that, even if he is real. But the point is that Abraham knew that God, but that's the point, that's how he was able to do it. Because he knew God to be good and righteous and holy. And that has to be the final basis of things for us. We seek to learn from Ezekiel's example, to accept God's plan for our lives. It needs to be the goodness of God, the goodness which we see supremely at Calvary. Amen. Well, let's close by